Let's get on to the interesting part of this morning. We have a keynote from Jim Gray, and I picked these two pictures because both I've been on the boat and I have seen Jim tell us how big things are going to be. Jim has a long history of doing things that influence us in very broad ways, from the rules of thumb, the five-minute rule for trading memory and disk, through Anand et al. And measuring systems, through the importance of the transaction systems, early papers in parity system, storage and parity systems. Mirroring is better than RAID 5, I've heard many times in many circumstances. And Jim is now off doing what? Looking at the universe through telescopes these days and building petascale servers out of commodity components. Jim, do you want to come give us a talk?
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I tried to come up with a talk that is not a warmed over talk. I'm afraid that many of you have heard all my other talks many times. And I will try to persuade you that RAID 5 is a bad idea, but only in passing. So, my goal today is to confuse you. Keynote talks, I think, sometimes try to tell you about what's going on in the field and so on. I'm a user, so I'd like to describe to you some of the problems I've been having with your stuff. And many of the problems I've been having are the fact that we are, I think, at an architectural breaking point. We are very near infinite capacity disks. I think at the first FAST, I was sitting in the audience, and somebody from Seagate was saying that they've got, pixie dust is going to help us get a factor of 5. And we've got this, and we got a factor. And he walked us through it, and he said, so after a factor of 100 more aerial density, I'm out of ideas. Okay? And I'm sitting there holding this 200 gigabyte disk drive. And I'm saying, okay, so this is a 20 terabyte disk drive. Okay, now I'm kind of out of ideas of what to do with a 200 gigabyte disk drive. I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to waste space creatively. Okay, I can't fill up a 200 gigabyte disk drive. And this guy is telling me that I'm only 1% of the way towards the solution to the problem I face in a few years, that we are heading for 20 terabyte disk drives. And I've got to come up with a creative way of using a 20 terabyte disk, or these guys have no business plan. Okay, and that's plan B, is that, you know, there's no business plan. Okay, and I'll come back to this, but the operating system and the file system are kind of like a government, and they have a tax, and a tax is heading towards 100%, and it's bad. We're going to be spending all of our time backing these disks up. We're going to be spending all of our time running reorg and check disk and things like that. The next thing I'll talk about is the guru gap that most of your users and, in fact, most of my users can't figure out how to get the great performance that you and I know how to get out of the file system. And I'll give you an example of that and talk about the story. And then there's a war raging about schemas and whether we should have schematized storage, and I'll just walk through that. And related to that is whether one should use blobs or not. When is a file system better than a database record for storing information? And it's the result is, to me, very surprising and suggests, I think, a way forward. And, of course, I do have to talk about smart disks. They are coming. I'm patient. Okay. So, you appreciate that processors are essentially infinitely fast at this point. They if you made them twice as fast, nothing would go any faster because they're always waiting for memory. The clocks per instruction is heading towards infinity. Routinely, the clocks per instruction on the applications I look at are 3 and 6 and heading upwards. The nice people who are making processors are blessing us with lots of cores, which is to say lots of processors on a chip. Okay, so every processor that that I have needs about 100 disks to keep it interesting. Otherwise, it's waiting for the disk all the time. Okay, so if you give me a four-core processor, I have to have 400 disks attached to that processor. And if you make those processors a little bit faster, if you, like on Moore's Law, the number of disks per processor is going up with Moore's Law. This is not a pretty picture. How on earth am I supposed to connect 400 disks to this processor? I mean, and tell me about the economics of this. I mean, the processor costs something, but those disks, if you tell me I have to do it with a SAN, I'm spending about $3,000 per disk to attach it to the processor. I mean, it's fabulously expensive to build a SAN. So, the other thing is that you might say, well, hey, memory is really cheap. And memories are getting very large. I mean, even the Intel guys now have 64-bit addressing as a commodity. Okay? So basically, everybody has arrived. And if you go and do what used to be called the five-minute rule, which is what's the break-even between keeping things in main memory or keeping things on disk? If you never access it, you might as well keep it on disk because disk storage is free, and so it's more expensive to throw it away. Okay? But if you access it once a millisecond, you should keep it in main memory. Okay, so somewhere between never and a millisecond is a break-even point where it's cheaper to keep it in memory than to keep it on disk. And so you go and you figure out, well, what's the cost of an access per second? And what's the cost of renting a page of disk space? And when the access per second cost equals the rent, that's the break-even point. And that break-even point used to be 5 minutes. And now it's about 35 minutes. And it's heading towards an hour. Okay, so what that means is anything you reference within a half hour should stay in main memory. Okay, and that cools down the disks a bit, reduces a lot of disk accesses, but not enough. And if you look at the TPC benchmarks, either the online transaction processing or the decision support benchmarks, they have vast numbers of disks hooked up for each processor. For OLTP, it's about 100 disks per processor, and for decision support, it's about 25 disks per processor. One is an accesses per second benchmark, and the other is a bandwidth benchmark. Okay. So, this just repeats something I said before. It says, well, so disks are heading for 10 terabytes. So it's going to take you a day to read them or write them. If you did nothing else and you did nightly backups, you wouldn't get finished. That's not going to work. I mean, literally, if you did nothing else and you did nightly backups, you wouldn't finish. So, and if you do random things, you know, and when I say random, reading it at 8K bytes randomly, it'll take you 5 months to read it or write it. Okay. So, it's also the case that it's a lot of inodes. It's 10 billion 1 kilobyte files, and we're going to come back to that in a while. This is, at some point, it stops being a file system and starts being a database system. Okay. You start having to use database techniques like logs and fine granularity locking and so on to want to manage the number of objects you have. And a million is getting towards the neighborhood of where you start thinking of, this isn't a file system anymore, this is a database system. Okay. And so the question is, how exactly do all of your favorite utilities work if you are constantly doing the following things? You basically need to be backing things up all the time or making copies of things because this is precious stuff. You need to be checking the checksums on things because bits rot and you don't want to have latent errors. So you want to find out that things are corrupt before you rush off to this backup copy and find out that it's been corrupted. Okay. Increasingly, people expect their file systems to be content indexed. So one strategy is you go through and you find all the changed files and you figure out what their content is and build a content index on the side. Okay. As files come and go, you need to reorganize the drive. So each of those things today is a separate utility, and each of them generates separate IOs. And those IOs are becoming an increasingly large part of the load on the disk drive. The other interesting thing is that there's somebody here from SNIA, and I know the SNIA people have tape and disk, but tape is now the most expensive storage you can buy. Actually, it's not most expensive. It's somewhere between RAM and disk. If something is mounted on a tape drive, it's more expensive than RAM. But if it's sitting off in the archive, it's not on the drive, then it's less expensive. So tape is pretty expensive. But there's an interesting phenomenon. Since we can't use the disk space and we need the disk accesses, we have a lot of free storage in our system. So, for example, I was talking to the people at CERN, and CERN is going to be collecting about 20 or 30 petabytes per year. Okay, so that's how much data is arriving. And they need to process this data about two or three times a year. And they need to read their data on a regular basis. So they need a certain amount of I/O bandwidth. So now you go back and you say, okay, how much disk bandwidth do they need in order to do their job? And then you say, okay, given that they need that much disk bandwidth, how many disk arms do they need? And that you come up with a number. And then you say, well, how much space is that? And it turns out to be about four times the amount of space that they need to store their data. Did you follow that? Let me go through that again. They need a certain amount of bandwidth to do their processing job. That bandwidth implies a certain number of disk arms. If you buy disks, and the estimate I was doing is 1 terabyte disks, if you buy 1 terabyte disks, they have four times the space they need to do their job. So 75% of the space is going to be empty. And they could spend that space any way they want. In particular, they could spend that space as tape. And if you look at the kind of bandwidth that tape delivers, it is going to be in the noise compared to the stuff they need. And so, in fact, the bandwidth, the storage and the bandwidth comes to them for essentially for free. Okay. So Garth says they could put it in another physical site. Okay. If they put their storage all at CERN, and something bad happens at CERN, then they would lose everything, and that would be bad. Okay? So the people at CERN have done something very, very shrewd and sophisticated. They have invented a notion of a tier 1 site, a tier 2 site, a tier 3 site, and a tier 4 site. A tier 1 site basically has everything. CERN is a tier 1 site. Okay? Tier 2 sites have about 10%. Tier 3 sites have about 1%, and tier 4 sites have a tenth of a percent. Okay? And correspondingly, they cost 10 times and 100 times and 1,000 times less because it's basically all storage. With me so far? Okay. So now it turns out that the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, which is at CERN, costs $10 billion if we're lucky. It actually has budget overruns. Okay. The United States, the Japanese, the French, the English, and so on, the Brazilians, have each kicked in hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billions of dollars, to this event. None of them wants to be a tier 2 site. Everybody wants to be tier 1, first class. I mean, they put a lot of money into the machine. It's nothing to buy a data center. So the U.S. will have at least one tier 1 site and lots of tier 2 sites. Brazil has a tier 1 site. Japan has a tier 1 site. So they're going to be, this is full employment act for the disk industry. But it also is the case that there are replicas. But that doesn't solve the problem. Each of those guys want to reprocess the data too. They have to do the same kind of stuff. And so the fact that you are doing it, you can do different reprocessing in different places, but the basic data feed, which is a substantial part of the load, actually is a big part of it. And in fact, sending the stuff to the other tier one sites is part of the load that this site has to have. So it's an interesting story. Okay. There is no good advice for these people how to do this. I mean, the simple statement is, tape is dead, so what? Just exactly how do I replace my tape process with my disk process? So what the CERN people said to me was, look, we trust tape. We understand tape. We've been working with tape for 40 years. Okay? We don't trust disk. Disks fail. Now, they don't mention tapes fail. But they know tape. They don't know disk. And you go to them and say, oh, trust me, disks are going to be fine. Say, so can you show me what the disks are going to be like in 5 years if I just put the stuff on disk and come back in 5 years? What's there? Do you know? No. Okay. Does anybody know? As far as I can tell, no. You would be the people who do know, and there's going to be a question and answer period, and you can answer that question. Okay. So there are lots of neat ideas about how to use the empty space, and you folks know those ideas way better than I do. Write anywhere file systems, copy on write, have lots of versions of things. And fundamentally, I think we're heading towards a world in which there is no backup and no restore. A world without backup. And what I mean by that is that if you have 30 petabytes and you back it up, what exactly are you backing it up to? And how long does it take you to restore the 30 petabytes? It will take considerably longer for you to do the restore than it will take for your boss to fire you. Okay? And because if you've ever, well, enough said. If you've ever been through a restore adventure, the phone is constantly ringing, asking, are we done yet? Do you have an estimated time when we'll be back up? Okay? And when that extends to past 24 hours, the guy at the other end of the phone is much less supportive than during the first hour. So the simple solution to this is that we have to go to not just duplicated systems, but geoplex systems and triplicated systems. And here it is, Garth. RAID 5 is expensive. Okay.
Expansive.
Huh? Expansive. Oh, hey. It is expansive, yes. All right. Thank you. Hey. It passed the spelling check. Okay. Fundamentally, one of the things we need to do is just to aggregate all the housekeeping IOs. I think I've already said this. But most systems, in fact, are not scrubbing their disks. Most systems are not going through and checking the checksums. One of the embarrassing things, and I think you are among the people who could fix this, is that there's not much focus on the fact that the disk can store sectors that are a little bit larger than 512 bytes or a little bit larger than 4 kilobytes. And you, the file system, wish you had an end-to-end checksum. And when the page is about to go out, you create this checksum, and when the page is about to come back in, you read the checksum, and you see if they match. And this will check whether the driver stack and the PCI bus and the controllers and the disk are doing what you hope they're doing. Okay. Many of the enterprise storage systems do this. But it requires that the file system that's using the enterprise storage system use it. Okay. And I will tell an interesting story about Microsoft, which is salutary, I think. Microsoft has a mail system called Exchange, widely used, and not very much loved. And it was getting a lot of disk corruptions, and the people who answer the phone were getting once or twice or three times a week a phone call from a customer who was just desperate because they had a corrupt database. And the people who were in the file system group at Microsoft and the people in the database system group at Microsoft were saying, oh boy, they must not be very good programmers if they can't keep their database. You know, they ought to just find the bug and fix it. And time passed. And they're chasing the bug down. And it turns out that Exchange is the only of the Microsoft products that generates a checksum on the way out and reads the checksum on the way back. And what was actually going on was the page really was completely hosed. And it was clear that it was not something that the Exchange guys had ever written. You could look at it and see that it's not the kind of stuff that they would produce. And it was turning out that there were pieces of hardware along the way made by unnamed hardware vendors that were not doing the right thing, and either writing in the wrong place or writing the wrong stuff. The moral of this is it taught the file system guys and the database guys that they need to do end-to-end checksums. Now, the database guys are in a pretty good position to do an end-to-end checksum. They own the page format. They can steal 8 bytes out of a page, put their checksum in there, and they're golden. Okay? But the file system guys are in an embarrassing position. They have to write a gigabyte of stuff, and there's no holes in that gigabyte where they can save secret things. So what they can do is keep a file on the side and then compare the file on the side, or they could keep a whole file granularity checksum, but you can't have a page granularity checksum in an obvious way unless you make a deal with the drive manufacturer. And parenthetically, it's quite possible to make that deal with the drive manufacturer. The SCSI drives have this extra block on the end of the disk block, and you could have a similar thing on the end of the SATA block. Okay. All right. That was a digression. The main point is that you need to be constantly going through the drive and looking for corrupt blocks. And when you find them, fix them, because latent errors are a very bad thing if you're building a fault-tolerant system. And I guess the other thing is that increasingly file systems are expected to do content indexing. Or there is a context indexing system on the side, and it needs to have events that come out of the file system so that whenever a file changes, whenever a file is deleted, whenever a file is inserted, that an event is generated to this coprocessor, which is the indexing system, that will just process that file. Because the indexing system can't systematically scan over the directory system on a regular basis and find the files that have changed, because that is overhead I.O., and overhead I.O.s are expensive. The last thing is that if we really are heading for infinite disks, then it's time to think about log-structured file systems. The bandwidth isn't infinite, it's just the capacity. So the capacity bandwidth ratio is changing. At a certain point, you just have to realize that you can only do sequential IOs to the disk. If you can only do sequential IOs, then log structured file system is the answer. This goes back to the discussion about the CERN folks. Let's imagine that we decide that we are going to take the empty space on our infinite disk and we're going to use it as safe storage. Now, many people are nervous about that. They say, well, what if a virus comes along and scrubs the disk? What if this happens? What if this happens? So there needs to be some way for us to fence off a section of the disk. And logically power it down. Because one argument is, well, I'll just power the disk down and then people won't be able to change it. Well, if the power down and power up is controlled by software, then you know the virus can come in, power the disk up, scrub it, power it down, and that's the end of that. Right. So this is just a suggestion. When people write stuff to tape, they feel comfortable. Now, the virus could come in, mount the tape, read the tape, erase the tape. Okay, so there are limits to what people expect the virus to do. How high a barrier can you put in the file system or in the disk subsystem that will fence off a section of the drive and only allow it to be written if there's a person present, or if it's a certain time window, or if the program is a cryptographic key, or something? So there's a whole bunch of technology and digital rights management that may be relevant here. Okay? The digital rights management controls what you can do with a piece of media. The digital rights management might be able to give us some way of controlling a section of the drive and controlling who can write it in particular. So now another anecdote. About 3 years ago, I went to supercomputing in Phoenix, Arizona. And I met Harvey Newman and Julian Bunn and some people who were part of the bandwidth challenge. And supercomputing runs a challenge every year to see how much bandwidth you can use. So I'm in this room about approximately this size, and they're sending 40 gigabits a second, or 5 gigabytes a second, from here out into the internet. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, "Ooh, wow, this is amazing! Wow, isn't this great? Wow!" And because it really was pretty spectacular. And Harvey Newman said to me, "Did I mention to you that this is just going RAM to RAM? That we're just sending the same 64 kilobytes again and again and again and again?" And you see that box over there and that box over there? If we go disk to disk from that box to that box, it runs at 10 megabytes a second. Okay? It runs basically 1,000 times slower. Okay? So disk to disk, 1,000 times slower than into the internet. Okay? And this is what the networking guys call this the guru gap, that if a normal goes out and tries to send stuff across the internet or across their LAN, things run a lot slower than if the guru does. But this is also true for file systems, that if people copy things from one disk to another, even inside their LAN, it runs way slower than you would expect. Okay? So I said to Harvey, "Well, hey, I'll make you a deal. If you will move at the intermediate million kilometers, or million meters, you move at the intermediate million meters, I'll move at the first meter and the last meter. Okay? So I'll get it from the disk to RAM, and I'll get it from RAM to disk as fast as you can get it across the internet." Okay. And, you know, how hard could it be? I mean, I think all of you would say, "Oh, gee, I can read a disk array at a gigabyte a second. Piece of cake. I mean, I'll go off and write that program right away." Well, it's true. And we did that. It is the case that these machines have, the machines we're working with, have kind of limited bandwidth in terms of the buses. And in particular, when you're moving things from disk at a gigabyte a second and you're moving things from memory to the network at a gigabyte a second, that's 2 gigabytes a second. And although the specs on various systems say that they have 5 and 6 gigabyte per second buses, the reality is that guaranteed not to exceed that speed. And there's this thing called a PCI bus, and your 10 gigabit Ethernet has to fit on this PCI bus. And at the time, the PCI buses were actually guaranteed not to exceed a gigabyte a second. In fact, even 800 megabytes a second was sort of the limit of how fast they could go. Now we have PCI Express, and things are better. But fundamentally, there were a lot of challenges. And I have to tell you that even today, we haven't actually succeeded at doing it disk to disk at a gigabyte a second. We're at about 900 megabytes per second. Garth? So the question Garth had is, who's spending the most to do this? Okay, so Harvey is not spending anything. It's your tax dollars at work. Okay. But the cost of a dedicated OC192, which is what he has, into another dedicated OC192, into another dedicated OC192, and it goes on like that. Each of those things rent for millions of dollars a month. Okay. Now, there are these things called gigabit Ethernet switches, and then there are these things which few of us have seen called 10 gigabit Ethernet switches. 10 gigabit Ethernet switches, at the time we were doing it, were heating up and melting down. It was really bleeding edge technology. They're now much more mainstream, but Juniper and Cisco and so on charge a real premium for their switches. So what we had at one end was 24 SATA disks. Net cost of that was $5,000 or $6,000. What we had at the other end was another $5,000 or $6,000 computer. Okay, and what we had in the middle was, in round numbers, $100 million worth of equipment. Okay. Well, okay. Right. But this is a prototype for what comes next, and what comes next is actually a huge disk farm at each side. Okay. And so let me finish this, and then I'll come back to that, because I think the next slide actually talks about that issue. But the users were really quite stunned. They did not know about asynchronous I/O, disk I/O, which is pretty amazing, but it's just not standard part of programming. They didn't really appreciate that big I/Os are better than little I/Os. They didn't appreciate. They'd heard all this RAID stuff, but they didn't appreciate that you really just want to stripe it as wide as you can. I mean, they're just, you think of all of this as being just very intuitive and ordinary and so on, but it was a bit of a surprise to them to, we said, lay the disks out this way, create a 1 terabyte file. And they said, create a 1 terabyte file? I mean, you know, that's more than 31 bits. How's that going to work? Okay. Well, it's 64-bit file systems. Okay, so just do all of this stuff and measure it. And given the instructions of what to do, they were able to get very good performance. But if they just did what they did ordinarily, they first would have written a program that would have gotten into big trouble the minute it got past 2 gigabytes, because their file pointers would have been in 32s instead of in 64s. Okay. I guess that's a picture of Harvey, and those are the disks and the two places. Okay. So going back to Garth's question, so the data is arriving in... Oh, boy. That was exciting. Hello. Well, I think what may be going on is that I need to plug the sucker in. I think it ran out of energy. So the data is arriving at a gigabyte a second. And that's about 30 petabytes a year. Just exactly... how are we going to organize that information? Now, the simple fact is, the CERN generates files. These files have events in them. At a certain part in a file, there is an event that says, at this millisecond, we saw these particles coming out of the detector. And then there's the next event. So these are fundamental. Inside the file, there are little files. Each little file is about a megabyte or two. But they find that unmanageable. So they take them and aggregate them into 1 or 2 gigabyte objects, and those are the objects that they store on disk. But they're going to have a lot of those objects. And then they need to build an index on top of all of that. Okay? So That's 10,000 disk drives if you triplex the data. And just exactly, how are you going to organize that? I mean, just ask yourself. I've come to you and I said, okay, you guys are the experts. What am I supposed to do? And parenthetically, what they're doing is they're building an Oracle system on the side, and the Oracle system knows the names of all the files. And the Oracle system knows some attributes of the essentially the metadata for those files. Okay? And when they want to find something, they look in the Oracle system and they say, go to that file and that offset and that file, and that's how they find things. Okay? That's, you know, kind of screwy. Their file system is Oracle. You know, is that the answer? Is that the right way of doing this? Is that what you would recommend that they do? Okay. I mean, if it is, then cool. Parenthetically, it's kind of what I would recommend they do, although I probably wouldn't say Oracle. Okay. But appreciate that. And let's imagine that I said SQL Server, or let's imagine that I said DB2. You all know what that entails, or you fear what that entails if you don't know. Okay? That means you've got this other set of manuals. You've got this guru who talks this weird language called SQL, you know, that is it's really strange. And there's this impedance mismatch. I mean, it's not a pretty picture. Wouldn't it be better to have a like more file oriented, you know? I mean, it doesn't. Frank, that's what I would say, but I don't think it's the right answer. Okay? So. And parenthetically, if you look at our friends at Google, they're not using Oracle as their index. And if you look at the people at Amazon, they're not using Oracle as their index. They're using something more like SleepyCat. So it seems to me that we've got the wrong abstraction here if we're going to go to a world in which there are lots and lots of files. And I'll come back to that in a while, I think. So... database systems are kind of fascist. They say, I'm not going to talk to you until you tell me what we're talking about. They're schema-first kind of things. Before you can give me some information, I want to know the shape of the information. And if you want to change the shape of the information, that's going to be a delicate negotiation. Okay? And file systems are schema never. We don't want any schema. That's somebody else's problem. Okay? And we do byte streams, that's it. And it's not quite true. I mean, in my youth, there was something called VSAM. And as I got older, I bumped into something at DEC called the Record Management System, RMS. And there was a very popular system called NetWare that had a very nice record management system in it. And there is this little company called SleepyCat that people use, and they layer it on top. And there's been, there's huge battles raging on XML. And what people are doing is putting XML documents in there, and the very first thing that an XML document has in it is, this is the schema or sets of schemas that I use. So the XML documents, in essence, can be or are just-in-time schema. Okay, or just as much schema as they need. Okay. This is out of place, I'm sorry. We'll come back to it. So why not have a file system and database system detente? I mean, looking at the CERN example and looking at other examples, like you have photographs, you have documents, you have a whole bunch of things, and maybe it does make sense, I take it back, to go and say the file system naming hierarchy isn't helping. Okay. If you've got a digital camera and you just have the standard hierarchy, your hierarchy is yesterday, the day before, the day before, the day before, the day before. I mean, the hierarchies are date. There isn't, you know, or which camera it came from, or and so on. Okay. So, and people are forever looking for the photographs of a certain person, photographs of a certain place, photographs at a certain time. And they want to pivot on many, many different attributes. If you look at Wikipedia, I mean, there are files down there, but fundamentally Wikipedia is indexed by the content of Wikipedia. And if you look at Wikipedias and SharePoints and Flickr. Oh boy. In fact, my indexing service is just finished. Okay, that was important. So there's this model that maybe directories are just standing queries. And there's a thin line between the things you want to look at right now and what is a directory. A directory is just a collection of objects. Okay. And files are not the main thing that people are going to be querying on. People are going to be querying on the contents of files or metadata about files. Okay. So here's the punchline to that, which is, why don't we have a detente between databases and file systems? And when I hope you're understanding now that when I say the word database, I don't mean Oracle. I don't mean SQL Server. I probably don't even mean SleepyCat or MySQL. I'm thinking of something which has a notion that a file has some schema associated with it, has metadata associated with it. And that a mail message, for example, in some systems is a file. But a mail message really is a from and a to and a date and a subject and a distribution and so on. It has a bunch of stuff in it, which is better stored not as a file, but as a record or collection of records in a database, and is heavily indexed. And so we promote stuff from the file, either from the XML schema or from the mail message or something, over into a structured store. And we have an easy way of querying the structured store and an easy way of querying the file. And any database record is a file, and any file is a database. In other words, be very ecumenical and say, I'm going to give you the same interface for both worlds. Okay? And take this just-in-time schema approach. And both interfaces, of course, have to provide security. Probably both interfaces can, on request, provide transactional semantics. And if you've been hearing about the Windows file system or WinFS for a while, I think, in fairness, this is what they're trying to do. Now, whether they'll succeed or not, it's going to be interesting. They're on their third beta. Each one is completely different from the previous one. That's not fair, but each one is very different from the previous one. From the point of view of this slide, they're identical. They all have this property, but I think they would tell you they're converging. I hope they're converging. I think they're converging. Okay. You'll say, but wait a second. File systems have poor performance. I'm sorry. Database systems have poor performance. I seem to be getting dyslexic. Okay. But the surprise to me, and this is a study that was done by Catherine Venningen and Rusty Sears, is that we know that for small objects, it's more efficient to get them out of the database than to get them out of a file. Because a database is sort of CISC. A file, you have to open, read, close. Database, you say select. Okay, one round trip. Okay. So for very small objects, database wins. For very big objects, files win. What's the definition of small and big? Okay. Well, a megabyte. If it's less than a megabyte, Rusty and Catherine did an experiment where they took SharePoint-like objects and put them in a database or put them in files and saw what the relative cost was of getting them out. Now, that's not quite true. The megabyte was folklore. It's what they measured. And then they asked the question, well, what if the file system is fragmented and what if the database system is fragmented? And the file system is better at handling fragmentation than the database system. So the number goes down to 250 kilobytes because the file system is so much better at handling fragmentation. Okay, now, what should you take away from this? If you're a file system person, you should take away, those database guys are beating us. We could learn something from them. If you're a database guy, you should take away, those file system guys are beating us. We could learn something from them. Okay? And if you're one of these ecumenical guys, you say, okay, inevitably there's going to be some size where the file system wins, some size where the database wins. Why don't we give them both and dynamically choose which approach to take? Okay, smart disks are here. Well, not quite. Okay. The premise is that if you look at a disk drive, even today, it has a lot of integrated circuits on it, way fewer than it used to have. But they are to the point where they have a system on a chip inside the disk drive. And that system on a chip is getting more and more and more functional. And eventually, that system on a chip is going to be a supercomputer with lots and lots of RAM associated with it. In fact, if you'd handed that chip to somebody in 1980, it would have been a supercomputer in 1980. Okay? And if you'd handed them the 8 megabytes that goes along with that thing, which is the cache for that machine, for the disk controller, that would have been the largest RAM that they had ever seen. Okay? So the processors and storage that we have in disk drives today would easily boot Unix. Okay? Would easily run on an IP stack. Would easily run a web server. Okay? So you can put a lot of functionality inside the disk drive. And again, it's just a matter of time, if not this decade, next decade. And it is kind of a puzzle to know whether is an iPod a disk drive or is it a computer? Okay, I mean, have we in fact put the application in the disk drive because an iPod is... Okay. How are we doing for time? 15 minutes, great. Okay. So you're not going to believe this. I measured these numbers. This is what I measured. Okay. How often do disk drives fail? If you go and read the spec sheet from the vendors, disk drives never fail. They last for 100 years. They have 1 million hours mean time to failure, which is 125 years. Okay. And so how come my disks are always failing? And they aren't always failing. This disk isn't failing, but its brother failed a month and a half ago. Okay. So, and my boss asked me, Rick Rashid, he said, geez, have you noticed that disks fail a lot? I mean, it seems like they just fail a lot more than they used to. And I said, no, I haven't. But it started me wanting to go out and measure. So I started asking people, and they say, well, we have numbers, but I can't tell you what our numbers are because they're too embarrassing. Okay? And many of the numbers here came from people who are too embarrassed but said that I could use their names without attribution. Okay? So Tom Barkley works for me, so he couldn't tell me that he was too embarrassed. Okay? And so we run a very small website, which actually has a fair amount of traffic. We ran it using a SAN configuration, and we were getting about 3% per year disk failure rate. Now, these are disks in the wild. These are disks in a hosted data center, but if you've ever been to a hosted data center, you know what that means. Okay? And we went from a SAN SCSI configuration to a SATA brick storage configuration about 2 years ago. And we've been operating the SATA bricks for now about 2 years. And we've been collecting statistics. Now, during the first year, an interesting thing happened. There was a guy working in the data center. This data center uses about 2 or 3 megawatts of power. And he was working away, and he pushed the big red button that says, do not push this button, that the fire marshal insists to be in the room so that you can shut off the power to the room. And so 3 megawatts went away. And all the computers in the room went south. And he realized that he'd made a huge mistake, and so he immediately pulled the button out. And so 3 megawatts came back up, 0 volts, 1 volt, 2 volt, 3 volt, 4 volt, 5 volt. Okay. And then about this time, some supervisor came by and said, you can't do that until the fire marshal comes and shut it down again. Which was the correct thing to do. I mean, honestly, you know, because the fire trucks were already on the way. Okay. All right. And so then the stuff came up gradually. We only lost 5 out of 180 disks in that. Okay? And in the lifetime of this measurement, we lost about 10 disk drives. Okay? But you have to appreciate, these are disks in the wild. This is what life is like. Don't plan that this will not happen. This will happen. It's just a matter of time. The halon will go off. A friend of mine was visiting Veritas the other day. They had a big fire in the data center. He said when he arrived, they had a petabyte. He had no idea how many bytes they had when he left. Okay? I never heard. But stuff like this happens. So these numbers are way bigger than the advertised numbers. And parenthetically, you ought to notice that the controllers are a problem and SAN switches are a problem. I mean, these are scary numbers. And the reason we publish these numbers is in the hopes that somebody would come out of the woodwork and say, you guys are full of it. The real numbers are, and they'll publish their numbers, which hopefully will be better than these. Okay, so if disks are failing 10 times more than the vendors claim, and what those failures were is those disks were sent back to the vendor. And parenthetically, the vendor 90% of the time says there's nothing wrong with the disk. So they worked for him, they didn't work for us. Okay. So the other, if you read further down on the spec sheet, it's mean time to failure of the whole drive. There's another thing called the bit error rate, the uncorrectable bit error rate, the UER. And what this is if you're reading and reading and reading and reading, eventually you're going to come across something which we can't read. And the drive will try to read the block, it'll try to read the block, it'll try to read the block, it'll try to read the block, but the error correction code just isn't working. And it will come back and give you an uncorrectable read error. And the rate on those is supposed to be 10 to the minus 15 for a very high-end enterprise drive and 10 to the minus 13 for the drive in this laptop. Now, 10 to the minus 13 bit error rate is a bit every terabyte, and 10 to the minus 15 is a bit every 100 terabytes, I think, if I've got the math right. So I took off 3 months on a sabbatical this year, and just before I left all of the machines in my office, which is about 12 terabytes, reading and writing for 3 months. Nothing better to do with them, right, except install security patches, which happens the second Tuesday of every month, happened last night. So we saw a fair number. We saw 5 uncorrectable read errors. So the UER rate is much better than advertised. That's the first thing. And the software was able to cover over, even though the drive wasn't able to cover over the UER, when the operating system reissued the UER, things were okay. We saw zero drive failures, and we saw quite a few controller misbehaving and software misbehaving things. And the theme of this is, so if you want to copy a petabyte, and we were talking about copying a petabyte, if you want to copy a petabyte, you should expect to see some UERs and some disk failures and so on. And today that's 4,000 disks, 2,000 to read from and 2,000 to write from. And if you take it takes 4 hours if it runs in parallel, but it's not going to run in parallel. And the things I wish I knew about UERs was better statistics on all these things. In particular, what are the statistics across the network? And so this paper that had the disk failure rates also has these UER rates. And I can show you my code, give you the code, if you'd like to run it on your systems. So there's kind of an elephant in the room that I haven't talked about, and I don't know how to talk about it, which is how are we going to do parallel I/O? There's no standard parallel I/O interface. Actually, I should really say there's no standard parallel I/O interface anybody uses or everybody uses. There's a lot of talk about multi-core and people worrying about how we're going to get all those processors, keep all those processors busy. How are you going to keep the 6,000 disks busy or the 10,000 disks busy? There's a lot more capital in the disks than there is in the processors. And in fact, the disks have useful stuff on them. The processors have useless stuff in them. And how, you're not going to be able to keep the processors busy unless you keep all the disks busy. And we got MapReduce, we got MPIO, we've got Parallel SQL. It's not it's not really a good story. Everything seems anecdotal. Maybe that's the way it's going to end up, but I hope not. Okay. So, the goal was to confuse you. We're at these architectural breaking points. I just don't see what happens next. If the processors get 10 times faster, it's 1,000 disks per CPU instead of 100 disks per CPU. Okay, tape's dead, so what? Can we live without backup? A disk is infinite. How are we going to use all that space? Okay. Overhead I.O., if the disk is infinite, overhead I.O. is going to be infinite. Geoplexing, log structured file system, the guru gap is still very real. And schematized storage is coming. And our fault models and our fault, the things we use to design storage with, is pretty dreadful. There's not a lot of facts out there. So with that, I'll stop. I was hoping to leave lots of time for questions, but I think I rambled on. Well, whatever you do with tapes, you can do with disks. Okay. So, that's what I kind of meant with, now the tapes are dead, so how do we replace it? And the CERN guys actually have, they understand tapes, they understand the whole workflow, they got the concept. And if we're going to throw tapes out, we have to replace them with something that is conceptually similar. But that's, so the tape stuff is kind of a red herring. Your main point is that rather than destroy files, you really want to corrupt them.
Yes.
And absolutely. Yeah.
Just proof of thought.
Good idea. So Ken Church from MSR has been also thinking about this infinite disk problem and the fact that there's not going to be enough data to, you know, fill the disks with, and so the disk manufacturers are going to go out of business once you hit, you know, a couple of petabytes or 100 terabytes. And so he's talking about moving the internet, pre-populating the disks from the manufacturer, for example. Why not move your search caches or search indexes onto the disks before you ship them out to customers so that, when you want to do a web search, a lot of data on the web is static, and if you have the stuff on the disk itself, right, you can, instead of hitting a web server somewhere, you can hit your local index, right? Half, or you could have DRM, music or movies or whatever, right, audio, stuff like that. So this is something else to think about.
Right.
Repopulate disks with information most customers are likely to access anyway, and stuff that doesn't change easily over time.
Yes. And in particular, I find that it's much easier to send complete systems around than to try and transfer files over the internet when things are at terabyte scale. Let's talk for a moment about the CERN story. Okay. So the guys in CERN are sending things to various data centers. The people at the data centers are having to buy disks. Plan B. Taiwan builds a disk factory at CERN. The disk factory carries, or in fact, you could ship them to CERN. Okay, the disk factory shows up at CERN. They fill up the disks. They go back into crates or racks, and they get sent to Brazil, or they get sent. Okay, and they arrive fully populated, much lower phone bill. a few weeks, maybe a week later. And so the Higgs particle might be discovered a week early by the guys at CERN. But you know, that one can do this trade-off. Yep.
So, Jim, I have to defend RAID 5. So.
Oh, good. And 6 and 7, I hope.
Yeah. I do run into these people who run projects and keep their disk drives at 30% utilization, but home directories in all of the places I ever run into are 90-95% full. Now, I agree it is the stuff that they haven't deleted that fills it up, mm-hmm. but they want more space so they don't have to delete the stuff they aren't going to use.
Okay.
So RAID 5's not going away.
Okay. Well, time will tell. Okay. There's some nice people who are doing an anonymously reviewed paper for some anonymous conference that went around and looked at the systems in Microsoft. And they looked at them, I think, 5 years ago, and the disks were, I think, 50% full, and now they're 30% full. And so this is a very good argument for things like OceanStor and so on, which try to figure out how to use. So these are PC disks. These are desktop systems. But they also have some servers.
And seems like an interesting thing for desktop space.
Yeah. So you could use RAID 5 on those systems. And you could do software RAID 5 across them, you know. But that might not be the optimum algorithm, and I think there are some papers in this conference that talk about other strategies for doing. But one strategy is just to store the thing n times in a very naive way.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.